That's good.
Sounds dangerous, man. I want to get kidnapped in the middle of the night about Bat mashing Tom Cruise in his Scientology, man. Hell no.
They're not going to do that to you.
Yeah, I think you're good, Edwin. I don't see you as the kidnapping type. I see you in the car for like 3 minutes with them, and then I see them pulling to the side of the road and letting you out.
They're like, we'll give you money to take him back.
Welcome, Secret Movie Clubbers, to Secret Movie Club Podcast 35. I don't know why I get more excited every time we do another one. Today, we are going to be talking about the Mission Impossible series starring Tom Cruise, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the mystery of Tom Cruise himself. You may not feel this way. I'm sort of fascinated by the tension and conflict in the things I like about Tom Cruise and the things that mystify me. So we may get into that as well. But mostly we're going to be talking about what a lot of people consider the surprise great series of the last like 25 years, which is the Mission Impossible series. And even beyond that, the weird fact that it seems to mostly just get better. And we're on movie 6 and they're shooting 7 right now. And to say by 6 of anything, it's only getting better. We'll talk about it, but there are very few series where you can say that. Anyway, who's with us today?
Hello, it's Daniel.
It's Connor. We're here and talking about Mission Impossible. I don't know.
It's me. Waking up.
It's the sleepy boy again.
That's not a Tom Cruise attitude.
And my name is Craig. I'm the founder programmer of Secret Movie Club. Announcements. Here they are. I'm just going to bullet point them. One, I want to give a big apology to anybody who had tickets to our Mission Impossible series or Coco or Nightmare Before Christmas. We ended up, because of weather concerns, having to move our entire weekend. The first time we've had to do it all season. But we moved it to Thanksgiving weekend. So we're still doing all those movies. But now they're going to be Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the 27th, 28th, 29th of November. So if you had wanted to see Mission Impossible and you were like, I can't make it, maybe now you can. If you want to see Nightmare Before Christmas or Coco, we were sold out, but we're already seeing some people who, because of Thanksgiving, aren't going to be able to make it. So we should have a few tickets open there. This upcoming weekend, God willing, we're not going to have the weather issues, and it doesn't look like we are, but I'm going to knock wood because I'm riven by superstition. This weekend, Friday, we're doing Back to the Future 1 and 2. Saturday, we are doing Raiders of the Lost Ark and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. So if you want to get your Sean Connery tribute on, come join us Saturday. And then Sunday, we are doing Pixar's Ratatouille, directed by Brad Bird. And I found out, actually, another gentleman, a Czech gentleman, whose name I'm blanking out on. I always thought that was a Brad Bird solo directing effort. Not so. So now I need to totally reconceive how I see Ratatouille, but it's still a great movie. If you have anything that you want to write us, you can always write us at community@secretmovieclub.com or podcast@secretmovieclub.com. If you have ideas, comments, criticisms, we do want them. I will read them. Program Mission Impossible because I love those movies. And we'll talk about 2 in a second, but I don't even think Mission Impossible 2 is bad. I just think it's just not up to the level of the other ones. The funny thing about the Mission Impossible series is I don't think in 1996 anybody could have predicted that Tom Cruise would continue making them and doing his own stunts on the verge of 60. He's almost 60 years old. But even more so that he would, as a producer, guide that series so well and find a formula where it's usually a new director. It looks like that's not going to be the case anymore. It looks like Chris McQuarrie is going to be on it, but a new director, a new voice. He was always taking chances, always trying to make them better. The first Mission Impossible was made in 1996, directed by Brian De Palma. Connor, do you want to give us the synopsis and then maybe take us away?
I don't know if I can give a synopsis of any of these movies because the synopsis for most of these movies is a bunch of spy stuff happens.
That's true, yeah.
Mission Impossible, I guess we should say, was based on a 60s show that I always thought was a James Bond rip off, but apparently isn't. It was kind of based on its own thing.
So not to get too deep into this, but yeah, Mission Impossible was probably greenlit because of what people in Hollywood call brand recognition. There's an even better word, like brand awareness. And there's a trend that has only gotten worse, but it kind of started in the 80s and the early 90s where if movie studios couldn't, like, they got nervous about original properties, so they would just take anything, an old movie, an old TV show, and they would just hope for gold. And Mission Impossible was one of them. And the original Mission Impossible starred Peter Graves, which we mostly know from Airplane. It had the famous Lalo Schifrin theme, which comes up in almost all the new ones, a Dynamite theme. And it was about a team of spies who would get a mission. The government would disavow them, would say they're not part of the government, and they'd always have to like save the world. That was the TV show. And Mission Impossible 1, basically, De Palma does a very Hitchcockian thing. We think we meet the team in the opener, and the entire team gets killed in the first 10 minutes. And it's like Emilio Estevez, Kristen Scott Thomas, just like all these people were like, oh, there's the team. No, guess what? And the only two people left alive are Tom Cruise, who plays Ethan Hunt, and John Voight, who plays the Peter Graves role, Phelps. And then what would become sort of, to me, almost humorously, the plot of every single Mission Impossible movie, Ethan Hunt is disavowed by his government and has to prove his innocence while simultaneously finding the real bad guy and saving the world.
I think the De Palma thing is what I like about this first movie. I like De Palma quite a bit. There's a couple of his films that are some of my favorites of all time. And this movie, especially in the first like two thirds, the last act, it's a little wonky, but during the first two thirds, there's just some really incredible sort of slow burn thriller action sequences. The kind that we don't really get in the later Mission Impossible movies. That opening sequence where everyone dies, and then the really famous sequence with him like rappelling from the ceiling.
Yeah, Langley at the FBI headquarters.
Both of those sequences are just like really incredible. Really well done.
I'm also a huge fan of the fish aquarium restaurant sequence.
That's good too.
But I saw this as a kid and I was obsessed with it because there was like a great video game on the N64 where you got to do the Langley sequence. I think rewatching it, I would probably rank the first one lower on the list, but like you were saying, it has nothing to do with its overall quality. I think it's a great movie. Just what the series sort of grows into is, I really love, is my jam. But this one in a revisit as a very unique, I think we'll get into it, but starting with three especially, it kind of becomes this thing that sort of feels connected, but one feels very singular, and I think two feels the same way, of like, these are two very different movies, and this feels like a De Palma movie, and I'm a big De Palma fan as well, so I love all of the flourishes that he brings to his style, and like you guys were saying, there's just some of the set pieces in this are famous for a very good reason, and they're just as thrilling as they've ever been.
That, throughout pretty much all of these movies, it's Ving time. Ving Rhames is in, I think, every single one of these movies.
He is. Only he and Tom Cruise.
So eventually, throughout these movies, Tom Cruise's character, Ethan Hunt, has built up a consistent team. And the first person added to that team in the first movie, who's been, has at least had a cameo in all the movies and has essentially starred in most of them with Tom Cruise, is Ving Rhames.
As it should be.
Other team members include, in later films, Simon Pegg is added to the team. Jeremy Renner has been added to the team. Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah, she's like sort of the newest.
We should mention, they kind of did sort of a Bond thing where there used to be sort of a single female operative that would sort of be in each film, and then after that film would depart. But starting with Rogue Nation, the fifth one, they sort of have shifted, and now Rebecca Ferguson is a key player in the subsequent films.
A really interesting story I heard just about Brian De Palma, because we will almost certainly do Brian De Palma devoted episodes in the future, so I'll keep this short, but I heard this great story where Al Pacino wanted to do Scarface, and he was looking for a director, weirdly. And De Niro said, go with De Palma. And Pacino was like, why? And he said, because Brian De Palma will make the most interesting version of that movie. He said, you know, he's not a gangster guy, but he's such a unique director. He will make the most unique gangster movie you could be in. So go with him. And I think he was right. I mean, I love Scarface. It's one of my favorite Brian De Palma movies. And one of my favorite Al Pacino movies, just one of my favorite gangster movies. But it's very weird. It's a very weird movie because of De Palma. I always call it sci-fi gangster. So I think Tom Cruise choosing De Palma for the first Mission Impossible was a great thing, because De Palma's just going to do De Palma if you let him do it. And he was really at the height of his game.
There's a few sequences that I do enjoy, especially the Langley scene where he's just hanging on a wire, which is really, really cool. And I think my favorite part of the movie is when Tom Cruise is fighting Jean Reno in a helicopter and he's trying to take him down. And there's this cool shot where he kills him. And the helicopter blows up in the tunnel, and Tom Cruise is in front of the train, just hanging out for dear life. And as soon as the crash helicopter is like coming right at him, you see the spike just like going to his leg. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That was a pretty cool shot. I love that.
I love one because of the sequences. And I do like that the reveal is that the original good guy in the TV series is the bad guy. I thought that was very clever. It was sort of a way of again, it's sort of Hitchcockian surprise about out with the old and with the new. But the Langley sequence is, in my opinion, one of the best sequences that Brian De Palma has ever made. ever directed. And that's, when you talk about De Palma sequences. But I remember even in the theater, I saw it at the Big Edwards in Newport Beach, because I grew up in Orange County in L.A. And we were all like, that sequence was just amazing. And I can't remember, but I think there's not a lot of score to it.
Yeah, it's very quiet. It's very focused on the sound design.
And they set it up so brilliantly, which is just real quickly, like he can't touch the floor. His body temperature can't go up. It's supposed to be the ultimate safe room because it's got FBI guarded information. He's got to steal the files.
He's sweating. There's lasers.
There's a rat, right? That's like gnawing up in the... And it's actually weirdly right in De Palma's wheelhouse to be doing all these Hitchcock... It's almost like, when you think about it, a perversion of the Carrie sequence in The Prom, which is that there's somebody up in the rafters, there's somebody down below, and he just sets up the space. So just if you want to watch great filmmaking, and we've already talked about it, the aquarium sequence is great too. I actually think the third act, I'm with Connor, I remember feeling like that got a little generic to me and CGI-y, and like, I don't even feel like it felt like it was directed by De Palma.
The second film, Mission Impossible 2, stylizes MI2, by the way. 2000 movie directed by John Woo. I think kind of like the first one, it feels kind of like they just let John Woo do a Mission Impossible. I don't know if it's as good.
Well, it feels like they let him go wild with some action, but they also like gave him a script that he couldn't divert from.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so the funny thing about Mission Impossible 2, which is my least favorite, and often with other folks, I don't find it actually bad. I just find it pretty, I don't know what even a word would be, kind of bland and confusing. The essential premise is almost like Goldeneye. Ethan Hunt has to go up against a bad MI agent, and the two of them are both in love with Thandie Newton, and there's a lot of ripping off of faces and different masks and this and that. And John Woo was put on it, and it's written by Robert Towne. So for people who like the inside baseball Hollywood stuff, Cruise got really enamored with screenwriter Robert Towne, who wrote Chinatown, co-wrote Shampoo, did uncredited rewrites on tons of Hollywood screenplays, including The Godfather, or at least contributed a scene in The Godfather. Coppola, basically, and Puzo did that. But and the script is actually probably the worst thing about Mission Impossible 2.
The script was also the story was by Ronald D. Moore, who's like a big Star Trek guy and like the really good Star Trek from like the 80s, 90s.
And it's about a plague, the Chimera plague, and they're going to release this. It's sort of like a biological warfare, I remember. But one of the things that's true about the Mission Impossible series is that as it went on, Tom Cruise would decide on the action sequences. They would decide on things before the script was written. That's true to this day. And you can kind of see it once you know that. Tom Cruise would be like, okay, I want to hang outside of a plane. I want to fly my own plane or fly my own helicopter. And I want this and that. And then they'd be like, okay, well, that's what Tom wants. So we're going to figure it out. And in MI2, we had John Woo speak for Secret Movie Club. And John Woo was very diplomatic. And I think I've said this before. John Woo is one of the nicest men I've ever met. I've never heard John Woo say a bad thing about anybody. Truly a heart of gold guy. And I've got to interview him a few times. And John Woo, when we were interviewing, talked about MI2. And he said that he kept getting pages. And there was just nothing he could do about it. Like Tom Cruise would call him and be like, what do you think about this? And Will would be like, well, how does that connect to this? And Cruise would be like, I don't know. And they both were a little worried about the script, but like the movie was shooting and there was only so much they could do.
I'm in the same way. I'd rank it at the bottom. I still think it's enjoyable. And it's like a very macho movie. Like the opening is this
it's ridiculous
climbing moment where he like climbs up and like he did it for real, which makes it scary because I don't like heights that much. And he takes his sunglasses off and throws them at the screen and it explodes. There are moments that are John Woo to the core that I love. The motorcycle, basically like chicken game. Incredible.
Best part of the movie.
My favorite shot that I still remember. This was the last movie I ever bought a VHS of because I was 10 when it came out. Probably came out on VHS. I was 10 or 11. And I never would watch the full movie again, but I would fast forward to all the stuff I loved. And the shot that's always stuck with me is big reveal toward the end. And they think they've captured Ethan Hunt and the bad guys have him in the room. And he's like not speaking. He's like, sounds like he's gagged. And the big bad gives a thing and he shoots him. And then he realizes that like one of the facemaker masks is like coming off and they reveal that it's actually one of their guys. And Ethan is in the other guy's facemaker and he runs down the hall and there's like doves and he pulls off his mask and it's him. It's dope. Moments like that are dope. I could not tell you what this movie is about.
I can't remember anything about Mission Impossible 2, except the motorcycle chase at the end is the only thing to me that felt really Woo. And when they leap off the motorcycles and grab each other midair and then fly over a cliff, it had been like I had been waiting 2 hours to see a John Woo movie. And I was like, here it is. And there it goes. And I still would watch Mission Impossible 2 for that moment and the slow-mo shot of the doves. But I felt like that was the only two moments they let John Woo be John Woo.
This is not my least favorite Mission Impossible. We'll get to it.
Hot take.
I probably would recognize it as technically being the worst if I would try to be objective about it, though I don't think objectivity in art matters. It's just too goofy for me to truly hate. It's 2000, but it's such a 90s movie. The remix of the song in this one is by Limp Bizkit. It's incredible. It's great. I like this one. This one makes me laugh.
Mission Impossible 3, for all intents and purposes, was almost a reboot, because even though Mission Impossible 2, I think, did decent, I think Cruise realized, we got to go back to what made Mission Impossible 1 work, but we have to figure, and this is where storylines that go to different movies happens, where Ethan Hunt, as kind of almost a priest-like, monk-like character.
It's interesting to think about the time, too, because 2000 to 2006, when Mission Impossible 3 came out, I think Tom Cruise had kind of a persona change, because I think during this time was when the couch incident happened, I'm pretty sure.
And Katie Holmes.
And he mellowed out. And you can see that a lot with, like, his Spielberg collaborations. He's in more mellowed out, older Tom Cruise mode. In the first two films, he's in a little bit, especially in the first one, he's in, like, younger, manic Tom Cruise mode. And he definitely changes starting with this film.
He feels like he takes his work absolutely 1,000% seriously, but he started to take himself less seriously. I think it shows starting with 3, where there's just like, there's a spark of humor to it that I think the series really rolls with. It just gives it like an edge where it doesn't feel so self-serious. It feels like he is, but everyone around him is like sort of in on that, being like, come on, man. And I love that about the series, starting with that.
And he's not trying to be like the most badass guy anymore. Yeah. I think he's more so embracing the almost like Buster Keaton aspect of the character that comes in later.
That's a very good connection.
Where he's just kind of running around and jumping off of things, and just he's just incredible at that.
Yeah, I love what you just said, because I think these movies, as they go, get more Buster Keaton, more silent film comedy, which is all about the visual action set piece. And so Mission Impossible 3 is written and directed by J.J. Abrams, who really would become known for rebooting series, probably from Mission Impossible, in his directorial debut. So Abrams, prior to this, had done some great TV. Cruise, you have to tip your hat to Cruise, saw talent in Abrams, which he was right about, and was like, this is the guy to reboot this. Abrams would go on to reboot Star Trek, reboot Star Wars, and et cetera, et cetera. But here, what we get is that Ethan Hunt is now married to Michelle Monaghan. And he's brought back into the fold because Philip Seymour Hoffman plays this maniacal bad guy, although like kills it, as you think Philip Seymour Hoffman would, this Davian character. But now that Ethan is married, they can get to Ethan through his wife. And for all intents and purposes, that's basically the premise of the movie. So Mission Impossible, as we know it, I think the seeds of it, of 4, 5, and 6, are here in 3.
I love 3. I think this came out like 2 years after Lost had premiered. And so I was like head over heels into Lost. And I had sort of revisited Mission Impossible 2 as a kid, and I wasn't feeling it really anymore. So when this got announced, I didn't really care. But then when I sort of made the connection that the dude who was involved in Lost was doing it, I thought that was exciting. So I went to go to see it, and I was like just taken with it, because A, I think it's just a very like effortlessly entertaining film, but also decisions like there's sort of this opening that starts later in the movie that's very jarring and immediately sets stakes that you know things are going to go very poorly just right off in the first like 3 minutes. And then you introduce the family dynamic, which sometimes feels like a gimmick, but the way that they play into it I thought was really effective, and again adds a lot more stakes that the other ones had for in terms of plot, but this one felt like it had for character for the first time. And then Philip Seymour Hoffman, who is so good in this, like almost like operating in a different world. He is a gift to everything he touches, especially the moments where he's having to play himself being played by another person when he has the mask worn. I love that concept in movies, and I think he kills it in that regard of sort of catching mannerisms.
I would say Philip Seymour Hoffman, in my opinion, is the best bad guy in the whole series.
I think so, yeah. I would agree with that.
I like all of these, to be perfectly fair. This is probably the one I like the least. I love Philip Seymour Hoffman in it, and I love all the seeds it plants and the things that come out of it. But I just can't remember anything about this one. Every time I think about this one, I draw up a blank. Like every other one, I remember like all the big sequences. I don't really, like there's a helicopter towards the beginning and then a plane. or something towards the end.
And this was a criticism actually leveled at it, was that Abrams directed it a little more like TV than like a movie. And there is none of the standalone cinematic sequences that we would expect before and after.
Yeah, I think only the bridge sequence is like the big like set piece I remember. It does feel like very connected as a spy story rather than like set piece dynamic.
Edwin, what's your hot take on Mission Impossible 3?
It's pretty good. Again, I've seen it when I was 13. I still remember it. I do have a DVD copy. It's in my shelf. I didn't watch it.
That's what they're going to put on your tombstone, homie. It's going to be Edwin Gomez. I do have a DVD copy of that.
I do remember some of the sequences, like the helicopter scene, which is pretty cool. And I remember also seeing lots of lens flares. I was pretty annoyed by that. Like, there were so many lens flares. Like,
Abrams and his DP loves the lens flares.
I didn't know who J.J. Abrams was until I knew more about him. Like, oh, this is the that likes lens flares. Like, who likes lens flares? I do love Philip Seymour Hoffman. I will agree, he's like the most intense villain ever.
I really like 3, although I think directorially, cinematically, it's in some ways the least distinguished of the entire series. But I think in terms of putting the onus on character and story, I think it was a good reset. I, too, have nothing new to say. I love Philip Seymour Hoffman. I think he's probably the best thing about the movie. I also think you see the difference between great actors and good actors. He makes a decision that nobody who plays the bad guys ever makes, which is that he never freaks out. He never panics. He's almost deadpan the entire time, probably because somebody who is a real bad guy would realize that none of that would really make any difference. So there are all these scenes where his life is seemingly about to go, and he's just like, well, you're going to kill me or you're not going to kill me. So, you know, I'm going to tell you what I got, what I don't got. And he makes it riveting. So that's what I get out of it. Now, I think here in Mission Impossible 3, intentionally or unintentionally, we actually see a movie that's almost autobiographical to Tom Cruise, which is that he's married to an actress who looks very much like Katie Holmes. And by the end of the movie, he can't be married to her. And the marriage almost like will continue throughout the series. But he also, by the way, infiltrates the Vatican in this one, disguised as a priest. And something that people don't know is that Tom Cruise actually, he originally was in seminary to become a priest. And he dropped out of seminary, I think right around Outsiders time, or I can't remember, when his acting career took off. But Tom Cruise originally was a Catholic who had decided he was going to be, his name's Thomas McPother, for anybody who doesn't know, Thomas McPother IV. And he was going to be a priest. And then that all changed when his acting career took off. But I think in Mission Impossible 3, you also see the seeds of this weird Tom Cruise being obsessed and devoted to his job, not really made out for marriage.
People always talk about how they have the one actor they can't stand. I don't have that because I'm an evolved human being. But my father had that growing up, and it was Tom Cruise. Maybe it was the last name thing. He just annoyed him. And so I never saw any Tom Cruise stuff until in the mid-2000s. I saw War of the Worlds more because of the Steven Spielberg thing. And then eventually I came onto the Mission Impossible movies with Ghost Protocol. So I caught up with these later. But Tom Cruise is interesting in the sense that, well, I don't know, maybe he isn't interesting. He's really good at throwing his body around, but I don't know if I buy him in like the more character-y roles when he was younger. I think he's incredible at putting himself in dangerous situations. I sometimes wonder if he has like a clause in his contracts where if he dies filming a Mission Impossible movie, they just have to incorporate it into the plot and use the footage.
Do you think he almost has like an awareness of that? Because I feel like starting with 3, he starts to surround himself with really interesting actors that take on bigger roles in the movies because he knows that he's doing something really specific in terms of his stunt work and like the charisma that he has, but he knows he needs like the team around him to sort of make the movie work and function at its highest peak.
So one of the things that I wanted to get into, I was telling our Secret Movie Club team was, and I know audience, you're probably well aware of this, is that since the early 80s, right around when he married Mimi Rogers, his first wife, Tom Cruise became a Scientologist. He converted to Scientology and has been ever since the most famous face of Scientology and is still a practicing active Scientologist to this day. This has been a great mystery to me. I don't mean to sound naive, but what I mean is this. Everybody who has worked with Tom Cruise has said he is the most gentlemanly, professional, kind, you know, like he listens, he's good at what he does, he's a great producer. All these adjectives and attributes and characteristics you would want to hear about somebody making movies. And at the same time, and listen, I'm open-minded, but I have to admit up front that I am not a fan of Scientology. I've heard horrible stories, including using lawyers to bleed money out of people, telling people still in Scientology they can't talk to family members, getting people to sign contracts where they give away everything and live in a cell out in the desert in India.
If you haven't seen Going Clear, the documentary on HBO, it's a harrowing watch.
And I've seen both and read the book. I read the book it was based on. And I just can't square Tom Cruise's professionalism with what to me sounds like just a bad institution. I got to say it. So,
a cult.
Yeah. And I say that with humility because I'm a practicing Catholic. So I always feel like like when you're
just part of a really old cult.
That's what I mean. But I mean, you got to be self-aware. I mean, I accept some pretty ridiculous stuff as part of my faith and my belief system. So I'm not going to judge other people. And so I want to throw that out there. But I do not like Scientology.
Here's the thing is I think that Scientology on a functional bare bones level, if you buy some of those books, essentially has a lot of self-help stuff that I think could be very valid. Its badness comes from its institution and the largeness of it. And so if Tom Cruise, like if he's a nice person, he believes in it, I can almost understand the idea, but he hasn't really separated himself from the institution. So it'd be nice if they could be like, hey, we're not going to do, you know, all that really bad stuff we do. We're not going to do that anymore. We're just going to let really rich people donate to us sometimes and not try to exploit others, because then I don't think anyone would have an issue with it.
That actually is a fix I had never thought of, Connor. That's the fix right there. So people could stick with that belief system if it did something for them, but the coercion and the extortion and the abuse.
I don't even know, is it really even working anymore? I feel like everybody kind of knows. The cat's out of the bag, you know?
You know, he's just a mystery to me. Do you have any thoughts?
For me, that's part of the allure in a weird way, because, you know, I've seen the documentaries about Scientology, and I have my beliefs on things, and my questions around like organized religion and how it's used in that regard, when it is sort of very clearly being used to keep people under the eye of whoever is the person in charge, that I find odd. And so there's a part of me that, I don't know, I'm sympathetic for the concept that someone could be stuck there and the strange mysteries around all the decisions Tom Cruise makes. And also this insane thing that I can't tell if it stems from just him as a person or if it stems from his belief that he almost feels like he might be immortal in terms of the decisions he makes in his movies. Where like,
that's such a brilliant point.
Why would you put yourself in danger to make this when like people may not, I mean, there's definitely people that appreciate the type of stunt work he's doing, but also with technology, you could fake that and make it look real and probably get a similar sensation if you wanted to, but there's such a commitment to it. And also it seems every movie he's upping things to become more and more dangerous, where I'm like, there must be something in his brain that is like, I cannot be touched.
If you're a movie maker or producer, your lead actor, the actor who carries the whole series doing those stunts, is a huge liability, because if something happens to them, the whole, you know, it happened on MI6, I think. He broke his ankle and they had to shut down for 6 to 8 weeks. But I mean, if he died, you know, it could be the Tropic Thunder thing. I mean, you'd probably get a huge insurance payout, which is maybe why they keep going. And they're like, well, when he dies in one of these movies, we'll get the payout. But
the reason he produces them is he has to use his production company to insure himself. He has to front the entire cost of the film, including like payout should something happen. He has to do that because no studio will do it, which is why he is the head producer.
And there you go.
I legit kind of think they have something if he dies that they'll incorporate it into the movie.
Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise because Tom Cruise does what he does. He's probably one of the greatest stuntmen ever, doing these amazing stunts all by himself. I think probably the best stunt he's ever done was the helicopter scene in
Fallout.
That one was insane. Danny told me that that was all him. Like, holy shit, that was all him? Holy crap, I gotta rewatch that again. That's a cool scene. But, you know, you can't stop Tom Cruise and his madness of insanity of stunts, because Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise.
So let's go to Ghost Protocol, which is Mission Impossible 4.
That came out in 2011. It's the first live-action film directed by Brad Bird, who at that point had directed The Iron Giant and The Incredibles.
And co-directed Ratatouille. Usually in series, people start to think by 4 on, you get diminishing returns. That's not always true, but that sort of tends to be the feeling. By 4 and on, you're going to get diminishing returns. The biggest surprise about Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, directed by Brad Bird, and the story generated by J.J. Abrams, so we knew that the level of quality established in 3 was, there was, I think Cruise kept Abrams on to, like, let's kind of figure out a story here, a story arc. The movie is better than 3, better than 2. I guess 1 would be, depending on what you think. I think better than 1.
There's 3 of these that I love, and it's 1, and then this one, and then we'll get to the other one.
Now we get the seeds of what Mission Impossible still is to this day. The team is mostly in place. We've had Simon Pegg in 3 movies. We've had Ving Rhames now as a major player, even though he's in all 6. Cruise is there. We have the wife, Michelle Monaghan, who may have just been wrapped up in Fallout. We'll talk about that in a bit. But now we get this 3 arc. Brad Bird directs, and if you thought 1 had 3 great sequences, Ghost Protocol has like 5 to 6 great cinematic sequences.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you're saying. I mean, 1, because Simon Pegg's role in 3, because this is actually only his second appearance, and 3 is kind of like it's pretty small, and in this one, he's like fully part of the team. He's great, and the sequences here are great. You know, Brad Bird, I think as an animation director, he understands like movement in a way that really benefits him in terms of these sequences, not just the big action sequences, but I always think about the sequence where they're hiding behind the like silk screen down the hallway, and they're kind of sneaking up.
Is that when they're in the Kremlin?
Yeah, and they're in the Kremlin. Every sequence in here is not just, there's like the really big wild stuff, like him climbing on the outside of a building for real, but even the smaller stuff has a flow to it, a visual flow that's really great.
And another trademark that would now continue, and it looks like it's going to continue into 7, is there's now always some stunt that's going to be on the poster that's sort of like, here's the stunt. And Ghost Protocol was the first one where you saw Tom Cruise hanging out of the tallest building in the world in, I think, the United Emirates, if I remember, Burj Khalifa or whatever that hotel is called.
Yeah, I love this movie. For me, this and Fallout fight for number one now. There's a lot of things I think Connor covered where you can tell Brad Bird's animation-based mind, somehow his choreography and these action sequences are, let us see everything, make them wide, and you feel it. I'll never forget, as I spoke before, I'm not a huge fan of heights, and there's a shot in this movie that if you saw it on the IMAX, the movie's in a 2:3:9 aspect ratio, but they shot one or two sequences in IMAX, and one of them is the building sequence. And the sequence starts with, they take the window away, and it's a cut back to Tom Cruise's feet as he walks toward the window, and the camera lifts over him, and it becomes an overhead shot, and as we swing out with him, and the camera even sort of hits the edge of the thing and like shakes. But when you see it on the IMAX, the aspect ratio goes from 2:3:9 to the IMAX is 1:4:3, but it's slow. So as he approaches the window, the aspect ratio grows, and I have never felt the sensation of my stomach dropping just viewing a movie as that, because I had no idea it was coming.
I think Ghost Protocol is my favorite. It's sort of silly to say that because Rogue Nation and Fallout are so much fun, and I also love them. But I do think that Ghost Protocol is so amazing, mostly because of Brad Bird. I mean, everything. I mean, I don't even know how you could say that. The acting performances, Jeremy Renner brings an intensity, which is a lot of fun in this movie. Paula Patton is great, even though it's like her one MI movie. So the team is great. The ensemble is great. I think they figured out the formula. In a lot of ways, I think Ghost Protocol is like the Goldfinger or the From Russia with Love of this series. It's where the formula is just the most delicious. And I would say for me, along with what you guys were saying, I am so obsessed with cinema, and when a director really gets cinema, the thing that I love in Ghost Protocol is the whole building sequence, which is great, which is like the Langley sequence where he's hanging out in the United Emirates. Not only are they doing this crazy thing where they got to go in a room and he's got to be on the outside and they got to switch and all that, but there's a sandstorm coming, and so the sequence doesn't, it's actually cinematically, they have to get this done, then they chase the bad guy into a sandstorm, and the sandstorms like consumes the city, and it's just watching a filmmaker who understands cinema. I
like cause and effect in action, because during that sequence too, there's like this switcheroo happening where they're trying to orchestrate a deal, and they're trying to get the two sides of the deal to come to like two different versions of them. He just does a good job with, I think, the fundamental piece of action, which is sort of being able to understand what the cause and effect of these movements are, and that being clear.
We get 5 and 6, and it looks like 7, have all been written and directed by the same person, and that's Christopher McQuarrie, who wrote The Usual Suspects, would go on to write or co-write a number of great movies or movies. Christopher McQuarrie has become a go-to writer. He became Cruise's go-to writer. He wrote that Bryan Singer Nazi movie.
Valkyrie?
He did the Jack Reacher pictures.
Edge of Tomorrow.
There you go. Probably the one that Cruise brought him on for. So then Cruise was like, he brought on Chris McQuarrie for 5, Rogue Nation, and now we get a writer director. The first time, actually, we get a writer-director. So there is a story sense, and it seems like McQuarrie can vibe with Cruise. And so if Cruise is like, I want to do a halo jump. I want to, like, ride a motorcycle.
Hey, Chris McQuarrie's like, hell yeah.
You got it, Tom.
Let's do it.
And so, like, I think you figured, like, Chris McQuarrie has that writer sensibility of, like, you got it, buddy. You got it, boss. We'll figure it out.
I think he also genuinely, most similar to Brad Bird, also has a good visual sense, but it's a little more stripped down and, like, purely cinematic. It sometimes reminds me of some of the sequences in, like, The Dark Knight a lot of times, like that kind of action.
Rogue Nation and Fallout, which would be 5 and 6, are very linked. They introduce what's called the Syndicate, which was actually the main baddies in the TV show. But in the TV show, they were like a mafia cabal, kind of like Spectre. Here, they're a little different. They're a rogue sort of organization of spies and terrorists who want to bring about essentially chaos. And they're headed by a guy who thinks that humanity is destroying the world. So he's going to single-handedly wipe out most of humanity so that the Earth can survive. They're like crazy environmentalists or something when you get down to it. So Rogue Nation introduces Rebecca Ferguson. She is as good a spy, maybe better than Ethan is. And she starts out being his foil and they end up becoming partners.
I like Rogue Nation. I don't like it as much as 4. And I would maybe even put it below 3. I'm not really sure. But it's so connected, like you said, so connected to Fallout that I sort of lump them together at this point.
They're almost like one movie in 2 parts.
Yeah. There's a scene in an opera house that in terms of this whole series from a directing standpoint is maybe my favorite moment of just pure direction of suspense, which is an assassination attempt during an opera that Rebecca Ferguson's character is trying to kill someone, or so we think, in the middle of like this opera box. And for that to work, she's waiting for a moment when a song hits that will drop this thing she's into a certain place. Meanwhile, Cruise is trying to stop this, obviously, but the way that it's built up and the sense of geometry that the set design and Christopher McQuarrie give you, it is this really thrilling sequence of just, it's this very simple thing. Not much is happening except that, you know, people are trying to stop him, this and that, but there's not a bigger thing. It's just someone trying to kill someone and someone else is trying to stop them. And it's so well orchestrated that I've turned to that just for inspiration because I think it's such a thrilling thing. But I don't think Fallout has the big Fallout moment. Well, there's two. There's the airplane.
Or you mean Rogue Nation?
Rogue Nation, sorry. There's the airplane opening, which is as thrilling as anything. And I know Connor, I'll let Connor talk about that. But the other one, it was this, because they always kind of talk about the stunt, you know, the big stunt that we did. And it was the airplane, and then it was this underwater sequence. And I think the underwater sequence is my only a little bit of a letdown for me because it doesn't feel...
Yeah, great.
Because there's so much visual effects to it, it somehow feels a little bit less... Everything else feels so real and weighty, especially that airplane thing. And that feels a little bit of a disappointment after that. I almost feel like the airplane opening is too good of a start. I think it's a very thrilling movie. I dig it. I dig a lot of the choices it makes, especially leading into Fallout. But I would put it on in my like second half tier of Mission Impossible. I was excited to see Fallout just because I love the series. And Fallout kind of blew me away. I adore Ghost Protocol, and Fallout operates in a similar way, but it feels more like a pure spy movie. And the characters it brings in, I don't even know. I just kept going to see it. It has so many, every set piece in that, there's an incredible bathroom fight. And there's this thing that they start to do that I think we sort of have touched on, where Tom Cruise is not so much, he does not feel untouchable in the movies as a hero. Sometimes the hero feels untouchable and it just strips sort of the stakes away. But there's this great fight in a bathroom after this, you know, the halo jump that we've talked about, where Henry Cavill and Tom Cruise are fighting this other assassin and they're losing so dramatically. And they both appear like they could take this dude and he's just throwing them to the side. And there's a great shot where this assassin guy takes out Henry Cavill for a second, like punches him in the throat, he's down. And Tom Cruise is standing up, having watched this happen, and just looks exhausted and just sort of like takes a deep sigh and like rolls his eyes, like realizing like he has to continue. And I love that as for the hero. I think that sequence is great.
Almost like an Indiana Jones beat. The biggest change with Rogue Nation and Fallout was that for the first time in the MI series, the director and the writer stayed the same. And Cruise actually, McQuarrie didn't want to do it. And Cruise said, no, you need to do it. I want you to do it. And so McQuarrie for Fallout swapped out the entire crew because he at least wanted to continue the tradition that each MI movie felt different stylistically. So that's just a bit of trivia.
I think Fallout specifically is the other one of these that I love. The movie it kind of reminds me the most of is like Mad Max Fury Road, because it is just kind of nonstop, relentless, real action. I think a lot about Henry Cavill reloading his arms and during the bathroom fight. There's just incredible little character stuff like that. Spoiler alert for Fallout. I'm kind of disappointed Henry Cavill's gone because he's so good in Fallout. But 5, Rogue Nation really cements the team. Specifically, I think Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson are all coming back for 7 and 8.
Fallout is great. I love it. Henry Cavill is amazing. I love his performance in that movie. He's a really cool dude, even though he's the bad guy in the movie. But damn, he's a good villain. Especially that bathroom fight is great. But again, the helicopter scene, it felt like something out of a James Bond movie. I felt like something that would be in a James Bond movie with Sean Connery or Timothy Dalton, because those ones had incredible stunts.
May have even been inspired. I mean, who knows if they're not watching old Bonds, because you're absolutely right. You only live twice.
Yeah, that's what I would say. It's kind of similar. There's a similar sequence in there.
Yeah, I like Fallout. I remember we programmed it at the Vista. I got to see it on film. It's probably the first Mission Impossible movie I've seen in a long time, because I haven't seen any because I was busy watching awesome movies.
Like Mr. Baseball for the 8th time?
12 times. 12 times, sir. Okay, 12 times. Get your facts right, Craig.
All right, and when you have a compulsion with Mr. Baseball that like we need to unpack, but not on this podcast. Keep going, sorry.
It's a fun movie. But no, Mission Impossible is great. I can't wait for 7 and 8, because right now Tom Cruise is having a great time hanging on a train and jumping out on a motorcycle. So that's something cool. At least he's doing some cool more stunts.
I wonder when they'll get to, like, they chop his head off and then medically put it back on.
Connor reminded me, because I agree with Fury Road. I think Fury Road and Fallout are some of the best action movies we've ever gotten. Like, I think Fallout is an unbelievable action movie in the same realm as...
especially of last decade. I think it's got to be those two, probably.
I think maybe I'm just still, like, high on it, but beyond that, there's just something... It feels the same way. I wrote, when the movie came out, I was pulled up my letterbox to see the review I wrote, which I'll censor, because I don't want to get my curse count up, but I said 2.5 hours of me leaning forward in my seat, palms sweating, internally shouting F yeah and cackling with giddy delight.
But that's a good way of putting it. I think Fallout accomplishes the almost miraculous task of each subsequent action sequence ups the sequence you saw before. So by the time Tom Cruise is flying a helicopter at the end of the movie, you know, you're like, this is incredible. I didn't think that he could keep doing it.
And then I also wanted to give a shout out to my favorite quote in a Mission Impossible movie from Fallout, which is, I think Angela Bassett's character says it when they're talking about Henry Cavill and Tom Cruise. And she says, like, you use a scalpel, I prefer a hammer. And I think that is such a great, great action movie line that then plays into their characters going forward.
Yeah, their fighting style is, and like their physical presence is nice. You talk about like Tom Cruise not taking himself too seriously. He definitely lets himself look way smaller than Henry Cavill in this movie.
I will just say with Rogue Nation and Fallout, I love them both. I find Rogue Nation to be a delicious dessert. That's sort of how I watch Rogue Nation. I don't take it very seriously, but I find all the sequences fun. It's funny what you were saying. I agree absolutely with what you said, Daniel. In Rogue Nation, the only letdown for me is what was meant to be the Langley sequence, which is where Tom Cruise has a minute and he's underwater. And it's actually the only sequence not shot on film in that movie. It's CGI'd out to the core, so it doesn't have the same feel. But what's funny is that he almost drowns, and then that leads into a sequence where doesn't he like brings himself back to life and then gets into a car and they have a car chase? And it's the car chase in Rogue Nation.
Or it's a motorcycle. No, it's a car chase into a motorcycle. You're right.
So to me, I love what happens after the underwater sequence in Rogue Nation. I love Rebecca Ferguson, and I think we get Alec Baldwin for the first time in the series. And I love Robert Elswit's cinematography. Fallout, you guys have already said it. I just think it's a consummate movie. I do think it feels a bit like a 70s movie to me. In a weird way, I look at Fallout more like the French Connection of all of them. It's a little more gritty, a little more stripped down, maybe intentionally so. Also, it finally addresses what they had let lie fallow, which is Tom Cruise's marriage. So in Mission Impossible 3, he's married. And that's left on a cliffhanger because Michelle Monaghan lives. In Mission Impossible 4, they're like, wait, what do we do with the wife? So he sees her at the end, and Tom Cruise meets up with Ving Rhames, and he kind of salutes her at a Seattle like fish market or something, and he's like, she's safe. So now he's not really married anymore, but he's watching out for his wife. Then in 5, we introduce Rebecca Ferguson, but what's interesting is there's no love story between them, which I think is absolutely the right choice. But now we're like, well, what happened to his wife? And in 6, McQuarrie said, and I think Tom Cruise said this, he said that all the fans were like, what happened to Michelle Monaghan? So in Fallout, they finally address it. She's moved on. She's with someone. Tom Cruise and her meet in the third act. She becomes a huge part of the third act. And what we get is a third act where, yes, he's saving the world, but he also has to essentially say goodbye to his wife. And that's what we get. So now whatever 7 and 8 are going to be, the lingering thing about his wife is done. They've said their goodbyes. He knows she's safe. He's moved on. And what's interesting to me, and I'll use this as my summation and then throw it to you guys, is in a weird way, the Mission Impossibles feel weirdly as autobiographical as Tom Cruise has ever allowed himself to be in a movie, which is, I'm married to my work. Whatever my personal life is, it's secondary to my celebrity and my movie making. And I am more married to the movie than I am to any person.
Nothing but love. I love these. It's nice to, I always try to be like, have a certain level of objectivity to like talk about things, but I just love these so much. I'm so excited for what's coming up. They fuel me with great joy. And after a great weekend, I feel really nice. I feel really nice today. And I'll say it's for Mission Impossible.
Yeah, same. 7 and 8, I'm excited for them. They're bringing back Vanessa Kirby from Fallout.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even speak to that.
Mm. The arms dealer. They're also bringing in Hayley Atwell, Palm Clementeef, and Shea Whigham, so I'm excited. I like all three of those actors quite a bit. They're good movies. Let's keep it up, Tom. Let's go.
Since Mission Impossible, man, anything's impossible. So
hey, it's not Mr. Baseball.
I'm excited for 7 and 8, man, because
they're gonna shoot Tom Cruise into the sun.
Well, isn't he doing a movie with Doug Liman that's gonna be shot in space or in those planes? I mean, yeah, at this point. Let's do it.
Somebody's going to like open a portal to hell like in Doom, and Tom Cruise is going to be like, I'm going to film a movie there.
I don't know that I have anything to add other than the Mission Impossible series is truly a great series. And that's why we're talking about it today. And even with the Bonds, when you really think about the James Bond movies, I think you could say that after a certain number of Bonds, you had to wait a while before another great Bond. They became fewer and far between. And to say that the first 6 movies, or 5 out of 6, if you want to go that way, are as good as they are, is a huge achievement. What's your final thoughts, Connor?
Woo! I decided I needed something positive in my life, even though some other things happened that were pretty positive.
Do you want to talk about it? I'm going to talk about it. Are we going to pretend like it didn't happen?
I am. No, you can talk about it. I'll chime in then. But I decided to pop in, do a rewatch of my second favorite TV show ever. First one's Twin Peaks, Freaks and Geeks, which if you guys haven't seen, is one of those super ahead of its time type of things. It's like 2000. And it's got, you know, James Franco, Seth Rogen, Jason Segel, Martin Starr, John Francis Daly, who's now like a writer, Linda Cardellini, made by Paul Feig and Judd Apatow. And it's just a delightful show. Awkward at times, but really fun, very heartfelt. It's the kind of show, there's no villains. So in the first couple episodes, the characters that you think, oh, these are going to be just the bullies all season, you know, they'll later have episodes that just totally delve into like why they are the way they are. And it's nice. It's a really nice show. And I play more of the ghost game with Daniel on my stream on twitch.tv/ConnorCruz.
I voted, and then we later found out that a orange haired is gone now because a certain someone won, and now he's Prez. And I always say this at the end of a game when I kill the bad guy. I'm gonna say it. I don't care how many curse I got, but yippee-ki-yay, mother Boom.
That's something that only Edwin says.
Yeah, I watched some stuff. I watched the Scooby-Doo movies. Speaking of Freaks and Geeks, Linda Cardellini, Scooby-Doo. That was not connected by Connor's decision. It just was a crossover that we didn't know we needed. And that first Scooby-Doo movie, honestly, pretty dang good. I also watched the new Sofia Coppola movie that was pretty good. And this movie called Shirley that's directed by Josephine Decker, starring Elizabeth Moss and Odessa Young, that was very good. About like a famous horror writer that sort of uses a young couple as like surrogates to find a story, and it's this very weird like psychological thriller to some degree that I highly recommend. Saturday was a very lovely day to hear the news. I am concerned for the months ahead, but it felt very nice to feel like I felt on Saturday, to be very transparent.
Well, and so I don't know why we're all like talking around it, but
I don't know either.
The secret.
If you've been listening to these podcasts, well, you know what? I'll come to that in just a sec, because I actually, for the first time in weeks, was going to actually talk about something pop culture oriented, which is I got to see Nicholas Winding Refn's Bronson.
And I actually
had to see.
It is a dynamite movie.
And I'm still
I'm still processing it, starring Tom Hardy, about a real life criminal considered still alive, Britain's most dangerous criminal, because he would constantly take people hostage. He was constantly fighting. He spent something like 30 years of his imprisoned life in solitary confinement. But he's also developed a reputation as a visual artist, as a poet. He's changed his name three times. He actually now goes by Charles Salvador as a nod to Salvador Dali. He no longer goes by the name Charles Bronson, but he was born Michael Peterson. It's a great movie. Watch it. For weeks and weeks and weeks, we've been talking about the upcoming election, and I've been asking folks to vote and not really talking about which, but just voting, and everybody voted. People voted, as you well will know when this comes out. Now, as was hinted at, so Joe Biden won. Joe Biden is our 46th president of the United States. It looks like he's on track to win by 5 million votes, even though it was a bit of a strange election because of COVID. The way the results were called on Tuesday were not the way that the results really played out over the week, because they had to count so much early voting. And because of the way that certain states decided, they decided not to count the votes until Election Day. So on Election Day itself, a number of states were uncalled. And then across last week, the states slowly were called. And it now looks like, barring a surprise, there can always be a surprise, it looks like not only did Biden win back Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, he also has won Arizona and Georgia, which puts him on track to have at least 306 electoral votes, maybe more, but probably 306, which in a strange way was the same amount of electoral votes that Donald Trump had back in 2016. And I didn't even mean to bury the lead. For the first time in our history, we have not only a female vice president, we have an African-American and a woman of Indian-American descent, by which we mean India. Kamala Harris is our vice president. Joe Biden is our president. And they together will start the Biden-Harris-Harris-Biden administration. What was hinted at by you guys is that still, almost a week later, Donald Trump has not conceded the election, which is no surprise. I don't know that anyone would say, oh, I'm surprised. But there's now rumors that he's going to go on like a tour, a rally tour, and do rallies where he says it's all a hoax. 2.5 months have in store for us. It's not that we're out of the woods, but there was a definitive result. There was a definitive person elected president, and that will be Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as vice president.
I mean, I was
about it, right?
He just found out the news about it being certain question. Well, I don't think it'll get overturned, honestly. I think he's gonna try. I think he's gonna fail. I was fully libbed up this weekend. I was like, hell yeah, let's do it. Now I'm kind of bracing for, at best, 4 years of Biden being called the most divisive president in U.S. history because he just addresses systemic racism. That's kind of what I'm looking forward to now. But I was happy. It was last weekend. It was nice. Last Tuesday was a nightmare, though. I was like stressed out.
I was about to say, Connor, you've talked openly about feelings of anxiety. Was that a rough day?
It was a rough day. It felt like my body was like in full panic attack mode all day, basically.
I bet. And then over time, over the week, did you feel the blood pressure go down?
Yes, I did. Now it's back up again.
Oh, and something, Connor, even besides some of the things you were saying, it does look like there's going to be a Republican Senate. Now, that's not a foregone conclusion. There are going to be two runoffs in Georgia. But it does look like the divided government we had from 2010 on, some aspect of that is going to continue. We don't know. It's not a foregone conclusion, but it would be really beating the odds if both Democratic candidates won the runoffs in Georgia.
It's the Obama shuffle part two.
Daniel, any thoughts?
No, I'm in the same vote. There's the same boat, I should say.
Oh, that was a good pun.
It's Tuesday. It was a very weird week. I sort of just like put my phone in do not disturb mode and avoided the internet. I haven't really gone that dark for a while. It felt kind of nice. I just like didn't want to know things. I didn't want any sort of a semblance of hope or expectation until things were a little more definitive. But then by like Friday, I was like, what is happening? And I know in like 2000, it took like, what, 36 days or something. But I am concerned for the months ahead because of the divide and the fact that a lot of the divide is so fueled by misinformation, and the way it is being spread is by the current president that creates this sort of conspiracy theory. I'm totally fine with, you know, these recounts and stuff. They can be recounted. That's fine. I think in 32 or 33 recounts in history, only two or three have ever been different. So if the votes are there, the votes are there, and a recount is going to show that. But this is weird. There's always like these buzzwords that people latch onto, and right now it's count the, you know, count all votes, and you mark out all and you put legal. But every vote is legal because we had to change, we had to adapt a system because we're in a pandemic that created a thing, and voter turnout being, on both sides, voter turnout was record, but it's always this pity card of, well, I didn't get my way, therefore something happened. It can't just be, you know, the people voted one way, and now that we're 5 million up in popular votes, I don't know what to say. There's a lot of things to discuss about that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, you know, we're a movie podcast, and we know we're a movie podcast, and audience, by the way, we know we're a movie podcast. We normally just nerd out about movies, but I do feel that when things happen, we do try to address them or talk about them, because I think being in filmmaking totally divorced from society or what's going on, I don't know that I think that's the way to be either. So I appreciate you guys being willing to talk about it. My thoughts, and I'm still processing them, but Daniel just said it. Joe Biden did get the most votes of anybody in history. He got 75 million and counting. But Donald Trump is the second person to get the most votes in history. And I think that people have to be careful about how they're reporting, because what this election means is it means everybody came out. Like, everybody came out and voted. And you can't say, well, whatever Donald Trump represented or whatever he tapped into, that's gone. Or that this election was such a repudiation of Trumpism. It wasn't. 70 million people came out and voted for Donald Trump. And I want to say that actually with this respect, and I hope I say it right. If we're going to get anything done in this country, it's not going to be, and this is what I like about what Biden said. And I suppose I should be upfront. I voted for Joe Biden. I haven't said that, you know, up until this moment. I don't know that people were in any moment of suspense about it, but I voted for Joe Biden. And what Joe Biden said, which I think gets lost a lot these days, is we're human beings and we're Americans. Whether we're Republican or Democrat should be secondary to the fact that supposedly we identify as a country and we're, you know, hey, we got different opinions. Hey, I think this is how you solve this issue. Hey, I think this is how you solve this issue. And I don't mean to be pie in the sky here, guys. I really don't. I don't want to come across as a naive Nelly. But I think the way the system should work is, hey, I've got my ideas, you've got your ideas. Yes, politics is dirty and always will be, and let's not be naive about that. But okay, what's good about your idea? What's good about your idea? What idea benefits the country? Because in the end, we're Americans and we're divided still. But I hope, and I guess it just starts with you, right? It just starts with you. You got to live your life and say, look, maybe we voted differently, but you voted and I want to understand. I want to, you know, maybe I don't have it right. And 70 million people voted for Trump. 75 million voted for Biden. And that means that you cannot ignore those 70 million votes. You got to take them seriously. You've got to understand what's going on and why those people felt that Trump was a better option than Biden. And I'm now working through that. And I want to do it with respect for other Americans, because I look at myself as an American before I look at myself as anything. I look at myself as a human being before I look at myself as an American. Then maybe an American, then maybe what my political beliefs are. So to the country, I really hope that the next 4 years we can talk to each other. That's what I hope. I don't know. That's all I got to say.
As long as that guy's God, I'm happy.
So there you go. Thank you, guys. Next week, we are talking about the Back to the Futures. Right, Connor? There we go. So, and we'll probably keep our politics to a minimum and talk about Marty. Whoever you are, wherever you are, we respect you. Watch great movies. I'll see you guys in a week. Peace.
Bye.
The Democrats have won. All hail Lord Beelzebiden.
Wow. Was that Tom Atkins again?
Oh, that was Satan.
Oh, okay.
hey guys, I'm so sorry. Right before this started, I got a call from my wife, and little Craigie was, he's 1 week into preschool, and he was acting up today. Oh, no. I had to call and just see what happened. And it's a whole parent thing you'll see. And he's fine. And the teacher was like, oh no, it's all good. He's only been in school for a week. He's like reading, he's doing okay. But these are, so anyway, it's a whole parent thing. I won't bore you with it. But as a father,
if he does anything bad, I will force him to watch a bad movie.
I got to put on my headphones. I actually can't hear you. I don't know if you can hear me.
He'll have to watch Mr. Baseball.
That's what I'm going to say right now. I'm going to say that.
It'd be really funny to associate your child with punishment with a, like just a piece of shit movie.
It is, but it's enjoyable. It's Tom Selleck, man. You got to Craig.
Tom Selleck at his best.
Craig, if Craigie does something bad, he is going to have to watch Mr. Baseball.
That's going to mean nothing to him.
He's going to enjoy a bad movie.
It'll mean everything to Edwin, though.
It would.